Mr. Carp, you've just told us that if you had sufficient manpower and cooperation, are you using the word cooperation in such a way that it could be synonymous with money? In other words, if you had money, would you rather...
Medium of exchange, and I don't know of any other.
I mean, is that what you're lacking, cooperation or money?
We're not lacking cooperation.
Then you're lacking money.
And we're not lacking too much money. We're lacking the ability to get an organization together as fast as we'd like to. But this is being accelerated.
Mr. Carr, will you accept me as a volunteer?
Volunteer what?
Passenger.
I thought you wanted to buy stock.
Well, thank you, Mr. Lanier. I will certainly consider it.
We'll give you his home phone number before you leave, and you can contact him.
You know, maybe he loves hard work. I don't know his qualifications.
It's a Martian exchange.
Incidentally, John, I think I have a little piece of news for you, speaking of volunteers. And you're often thinking of the 27 states in which your program is heard. We had a conversation by phone with a man in Oklahoma City who says he hears your program frequently out there.
Well, when I went out to California, I met three or four people out there that claim that they have heard the program in California, the New York program. But this is very, very unusual. I don't know, it's atmospheric conditions, the day is great or something, and they've heard it. I'm not kidding you.
May I add, Long John is driving to Arizona, came in beautifully.
Huh?
Arizona, yes. Yeah. And in fact, the only place in the West I didn't pick yet, but I got you in Arizona just as clear as...
As a local station? As clear as a local station?
As clear as a local station. On my car while I was driving.
This is WOR Radio, your station in New York, Long John with the party line. Here's a telegram from Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning to yourself and panel. Tell Mr. Carr, Mr. Colton, many Baltimore friends listening. Program coming in loud and clear. William J. Kennedy. Here's one more. This is to Otis T. Carr, Baltimore, from Baltimore, Maryland. Congratulations on your marvelous presentation of our dedicated project. Wish I were near to cheer you on. It is magnificent. I am listening intently. Bud Gosnell. And we have some other telegrams. We'll try to catch up with those in just a moment.
Ben was delayed getting to the studios this morning. He left a message for me about 11 o'clock in the studios. I came in by bus from Jersey tonight instead of driving in, so I was a little delayed myself. Ben, you've had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Colton, Mr. Carr, before. I noticed you were looking at, what do you call them, plans? The ones we have?
The model kit plans.
Oh, the model kit plans. You were looking at those, You expressed some amazement about the presentation. Would you want to comment on that?
Oh, I think the presentation is very beautiful and extremely elaborate. It's quite a fine piece of work. I mean, what more can I say?
Well, I mean, I don't want you to... You know, say something that you don't want. I noticed that
what?
You were looking at your opinion.
I was wondering, is this kit to build a model circular foil craft?
Yes, I'm glad to hear you express those opinions about it, because the people who are waiting who have not yet received them because of the printing delays will know that when they do get them that they will be something very special.
Well, with this model, will this also fly?
We had some discussion about that before you arrived. This model, as you see it expressed on these plans, can be made to fly when it's properly energized.
Mm-hmm. You want to move over here, Ben? I'm sorry, we had a little difficulty with that microphone. No, accidentally, it was too close to a magnetic field over there.
Ben always has trouble with magnetic fields.
You came up a little
other
bit.
Ones.
Mr. Keene, would you care to sign out? Just say something nice to Mr. Keene. Say good morning, Jack Keene.
One, two, three.
Is that all right, Dr.
Can you go to five?
I didn't change the mics around this morning.
Well, what seems to be wrong, Jack? I mixed them up when I moved the chairs around. No, absolutely not.
I suspect this has something to do with Ben's concern with other magnetic fields.
Well, I don't think that Ben can comment on that for a moment. We're having a slight technical difficulties at the moment. And it is quite possible. When we moved the table, we lifted the entire table to move it into a position where we would get more light on the literature that the gentlemen were kind enough to bring with them this morning. And evidently, in doing that, we may have disconnected one of the cables. And do you want to try it again now, Jack? Did you say something again?
Good morning, Mr. King.
Beautiful, huh? Did you record that? But we could sell 150,000 copies of that. Isn't that a wonderful way to get up in the morning?
And now because W.O. Longer is there.
You may ask your question now, Ben.
Well, the question I asked was, if a person gets his model kit and he builds a model, will it fly?
Well, there's a test of the mic in front of me, see if it's working properly. And to avoid any misimpression among the listeners that everyone who gets a kit of model plans will be able to make a flying model, the answer is no. The basic model to be built from these plans is much the same as any other hobby model kit of conventional craft and of locomotives or other things that boys build out of balsa wood, but what this set of model plans will do beyond that is demonstrate physically all of the new principles of Mr. Carr's spacecraft design and the electro-gravitational power package that will energize the actual full-scale craft that he will pilot to the moon next December 7th.
Mr. Colton, I wonder if you could take the top off the flying saucer so that Ben could see the inside. What the kit's going to build.
Yes, with the kit you can build it.
Mr. Colton, would you activate it first before you take it off?
I wonder, it's going to be rather inconvenient, but can you keep on, Michael? That's it. Move it over there.
Resolve the hull section first, and you'll notice that as the entire hull revolves, it's a 25-inch diameter circular hull. The landing gear, the tripod landing gear, which is on the table, and the crew compartment, both are motionless. This is the first time, I believe, we've shown you people here a demonstration of the fact that the crew compartment, the hull section, and the internal clockwise rotating disc, all mounted on a single shaft, enable the landing gear and the crew compartment to remain motionless. So we're stationary. This hole removes from the central shaft as one assembly, and you can see how the internal struts or rib truss construction supports the external skin.
Can you just show that to me again a moment? Would you describe that again, please?
Well, this is a section which, in a plan view, is a 25-inch diameter circle.
Mm-hmm.
Externally, you see a smooth skin, which on the actual flying craft will be of sheet aluminum or duralumin.
I'd like to see the back again.
This is supported structurally by 48 ribs or truss members, which are reinforced by circular ribs.
Mm-hmm.
This is very similar to the type of truss which supports a roof. Looking at this in one way in a half section, you might say that it's a roof over an inverted roof to form the mm-hmm. two sections of the outer hull. It's very beautifully made.
That it is. Do you want to hold out a moment
Dave Fields for Mr. Colton. Thank you very much. Now, will you describe the interior of the OTC circular foil craft?
Well, we've removed the upper portion of the hull, and we've exposed the central core, which is the Utron electrical accumulator, which in turn supports a complex of capacitor plates. That's these plates here, which are painted aluminum, and which will actually be a heavy aluminum plate. This is the Utron electrical accumulator.
Will this operate without fuel? Does it create its own fuel? Is this what we call free energy?
Well, what you would call fuel is contained in the central power package, which is the Utron accumulator. And this is an electrochemical storage battery.
It is a battery, and we know it, sir?
It is essentially analogous to the batteries as you learn, compared to lead and zinc and a weak solution of acid.
How many
an electrochemical accumulator. And it provides the inertial excitation, which starts the central disk turning in the magnetic field.
How many volts would this battery have, Mr. Colton? The one that you described.
Might have any imaginable number of volts, from 1.5 to 1.5 million. The voltage required for the 45-foot craft that Mr. Carr will take to the moon, I understand, will be about 12,000 volts.
That will be an adequate amount.
Yes.
May I say, Ron John, that this battery, this accumulator, this Utron electrical accumulator, will weigh approximately 4 tons, and we think it will be the world's largest power package of electricity made to date. That is stored electrochemically.
Mm-hmm. Is there any possibility, and I'm not trying to be facetious, Mr. Carr, is there any possibility that battery could go dead during the trip?
There is this possibility.
I mean, we do know that batteries have gone dead in
cars. It would be like a hole in the ship. We'd be in trouble. Mm-hmm. We'd be captive in space, in orbit, and until we built another craft and come up and got us, we'd be in trouble.
Well, let us say this happened, and I sincerely hope that it doesn't.
If you were in orbit and you're captive in space, and they build another one, let's say it takes 3 months to build a new one, what would happen when the new one meets you in space and you're in orbit?
How do you get together?
Well, they would have to bring along those facilities. Can you describe those facilities, please?
It would be very similar to the transfer from a submarine to the surface.
I'm not familiar with that. Could you describe that to me?
This and the diving bell and other facilities are wherein a seal area pressure is elevated from one area to another. And this would have to be done in space.
Mm-hmm.
Now, incidentally,
what would happen, pardon me, Mr. Carr, what would happen
to the original craft? We now assume that the battery is dead.
Do we jump this? Does it burn up? What happens to it?
I imagine it may stay up there until man went up and dismantled it, which wouldn't be too much difficulty. Incidentally, in space, John, we could build a craft like this several thousand feet in diameter by filling up the materials and letting them float around until we used them.
We could use this 45-foot craft and haul up a few pieces of material at a time and build you the most elaborate ship you'd ever want to see out in space. No trouble at all.
Could you build a new battery in space?
Yeah, could be done. Could be done.
You don't seem to be the least bit concerned about the possibility of a battery.
No, we don't. I just can't conceive of us not checking out and making certain that these principles will be sound for this very quick voyage, 7 days.
I have read in the newspapers in recent months that they've had difficulties at Cape Canaveral, and they've spent a considerable amount of time building the rockets and
this happens, that happens, something goes wrong, and certainly they didn't foresee these things. I was just wondering, do you honestly think that it's quite as simple as you expressed it this morning?
We'll check it out.
This is a good time to point out, and you can see it physically demonstrated and can be explained for your listeners, that while some of these very elaborate and magnificent rockets are comprised of more than 300 parts, this model craft that you see here has only two moving parts.
Only two?
External hull.
Yes.
Which is the two joined upper and lower discs,
mm-hmm.
dish-shaped discs,
mm-hmm.
and the central disc, which rotates clockwise, and all sections rotate counterclockwise, are the only two moving parts of the craft.
I have a question here from Paul Ballard, associate editor of Argosy magazine. Some military experts consider Moon highly strategic. Has our government taken security measures on Carr's invention? If not, why not?
Well, the question would have to be answered by the government.
We went into that a little earlier, as a matter of fact. Mr. Carr did say something about that.
You mean about going straight up?
No. It was about the Russians. And Mr. Carr said that he thought there was a possibility that the Russians had already built a machine similar to his, a flying saucer, and that they could possibly...
That they may be on the moon
may,
at
the
this
Russians
time.
The Russians may actually be on the moon at
and
this time.
And that they're not bragging about it.
Well, Mr. Carr did not say that this was true. He said it was possible.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much conjecture contained in a statement like that. In the first place, we don't know that it is actually strategic. It takes as much effort to get from the moon to the Earth as it does to get from the Earth to the moon. And so until some so-called enemy gets to the moon, he obviously can't get from the moon to the Earth.
I was just wondering, in the January edition of Argosy magazine, I don't know, I think it's January, possibly February, that Jules B. St. Germain, the attorney from Lynbrook, Long Island, will have a story in either the January or February edition, and it's in reference to the spacecraft convention that was held in Lebanon, New Jersey. Now, maybe Jules will have some opinions about the craft, because I think he met you gentlemen at the convention out there, and of course... I've been told by Bailey, Herb Bailey, that there will be an article in Argosy magazine about the party line and about a number of the people that have appeared during the past year in the March or April edition of Argosy, and possibly Paul Ballas, the associate editor of Argosy magazine, will have some ideas about that, and I sincerely hope that they incorporate in the article at least one photograph of the model as we see it this morning. That's why Sam Vandenberg got out of bed to get over here when he was listening to the program, and he called me and he said, John, he said, I better hustle over to get pictures of this, because this will be a great shot for Argosy, and I hope it all works out. Then
they will certainly, be historic pictures, John, because to get back to Argosy, we'd like to assure Argosy and every other periodical publication in this country and the world that the OTC Enterprises devices, the OTC-X1 craft, is purely a transportation device for peaceful travel and exploration of this planet and other planets in the solar system and the universe.
It could very easily be adopted to be a military weapon.
If it were, it would have to be by someone else.
Well, no, and I assume by someone else. It could very easily be adopted.
Are you refusing to give it to the government for military purposes?
Well, we would hardly be in such a position. As we have stated in our published literature, we have fervently hoped that no OTC device will ever be used for a destructive purpose.
Well, what about national defense?
Well, you only need defense when there's offense. And if we all get busy traveling and exploring and looking for nice people in other places around the universe, there won't be any offense.
Why do you assume that people are going to be nice? If there are people on the moon or Mars,
well,
why do these people necessarily have to be nice? Why can't they be miserable like
Evidently, you think that the Earth people are. I don't.
Incidentally.
Well, in the 5 million years of life on this planet, there is no record that it's ever been attacked by people from any other planet. So,
well, maybe they didn't have Otis T. Cards on the other planet.
5 million years of human life on this planet?
That's life, I think.
Oh.
Ezekiel saw a spacecraft 3,000 years ago.
Well, then, so they have the Mahabharata records spacecraft,
yeah,
too. And thus, and pure mythology is recognized amongst Hindu authorities.
We don't know who built the Pyramid of Giza.
We don't?
No.
It wasn't Khufu, the pharaoh?
It was not.
Who was it?
We don't know.
I killed Kinephron.
There were four different pronunciations.
The curfew was an excellent name.
Something new.
That is rewriting history.
We don't know who built the Sphinx.
Oh, no, I wouldn't.
We don't know who built what?
Yes, the Sphinx, but we know who broke its nose.
Napoleon tried.
Why don't we know who built the Pyramid of Giza?
Because it's never been duplicated.
Well,
and anything that is of this stature, if man did it once, he would do it again.
Why? He would what?
He could do it again.
Not necessarily.
The Pylon and the Pedestrian, the New York World Fair was a great structure. It was built once. It was never duplicated.
Give it time.
The principles. But this has been standing for thousands of years. Our very finest masons cannot duplicate the structure of stone that is put there. When we build with masonry now and all our science and our lifting devices, there is still gaps between. It has to be filled with mortar. I understand that you can't get a playing card between 70-ton blocks of the giant Pyramid of Giza.
Mr. Carr, have you ever seen the Pyramid of Giza?
Outside of Columbus, there's a shopping center, and they have the Seven Wonders of the World reproduced there very beautifully, and they have the Pyramid of Giza.
Columbus, Ohio?
Have
you ever seen the Pyramid of Giza?
Wonderful. Magnificent.
Have you ever seen the Pyramid of Giza?
This I saw a replica model.
No, in Egypt. Oh, he worked with a model. You know,
a model.
You know that little Egyptian boys run up and down that pyramid for quarters? Because these blocks of masonry are so close together that they can actually run up and down them like steps.
One
like a ladder, you know.
And you can have a playing card between them, and you can get a small boy between them.
You can put your foot between them, but look, that's what you are referring to, the masonry after the top covering was removed by spoilers. You know that, don't you?
Right.
Well, I think that I can take Mr. Carr down to downtown Manhattan and show him some fine examples of masonry that are better than the Pyramid of Giza.
I doubt it. Not by weight. Not by 70-ton weight.
All right, let's say it's a 70-ton weight. What is so...
How did they lift it into position? That is the question.
Right. And place it so accurately that its measurements were such that you could sight Polaris within 1/10,000th of an inch.
Well, this, of course, is planned, sighting of Polaris.
Absolutely.
What about Cleopatra's needle?
It was not Polaris, please.
What was it?
Another star. Polaris wasn't there at the time.
Oh. It wasn't?
No.
Not at the time it was built. They don't think, of course, this is conjectural.
Well, we're pretty sure that it wasn't Polaris.
Well, you know, I imagine the Hanging Gardens of Babylon are considered pretty astounding also. And do you think space people grew and planted these gardens?
We don't particularly think, but we're quite confident that Ezekiel or spacecraft.
Well, I don't know about Ezekiel. I'm getting more interested in the Pyramid of Giza. I always wonder, I mean, I heard this from Dan Fry also. I always wonder why people pick on that poor pyramid. Why do people always assume that the thing was built by spacecraft? When there are records, there are carvings all over it, or there are historical records of the Egyptian dynasty?
The duplicate.
Several other buildings exactly like it nearby, built by other pharaohs.
Exactly.
This one happens to be larger.
No, not exactly. Any student of these pyramids will tell you that they are not exactly like it. They're far different.
Yeah, it's much larger.
And also the inscriptions, which have not all been deciphered, are entirely different. However, getting back to this
possibility of visitation from people from space over the centuries. There has always been, we feel, some visitation. Now, it's only been in the past few years that this has been accelerated.
We also feel that after the OTCS-1 and other craft like it are built, and we too have gone into space, this whole mystery will cease to be a mystery any longer. We think that people from other planets will begin to identify themselves. Some of them, it may be very difficult for them to be in this atmosphere, but maybe an exchange of ideas will be good on both sides. We may have to find out how to live on their planet. They may have to find out how to live on ours. This is all going to be good. A new space age, there has been others we confidently feel, is in the making, and we feel that we have a little bit of part in this history, in the fact that we know the principle we have that sound and accurate and that our craft will fly outside the atmosphere, manned, and return.
Have you solved the reentry problem?
There isn't any problem. We carry a force field with us that eliminates it.
Mr. Carr, then we eliminate the temperature?
There is no temperature that we can't withstand inside our craft because our force field totally sets up like the same as a vacuum.
Well, what speed will you re-enter the atmosphere?
About 25,000 miles per hour.
Will we enter the Earth's atmosphere at 25,000 miles?
Not in the immediate atmosphere, no. We'll be down to around, it's a heavy side layer, it'll be 18,000 miles per hour.
That's fast enough. And you will not burn up?
Not at all.
Why not?
I don't feel it. Because our force field will protect
us. Well, I can say that you won't burn up because wishing makes it so. Why will it, what force field?
Do you understand? Let me tell you something about force field.
Right, do that.
The only one that we are experienced with is in our craft. But there are others demonstrating here on this planet. And a very good one is an acetylene torch. When a man, a diver, can go down 100 feet underwater and use an organic flame and burn just as well with millions of tons of pressure of water around him as he does out in the open. The reason being that this flame has a force field around it, and not one drop of water gets through to it.
What is this force field composed
of? It's composed of, in this particular instance of acetylene torch, the pressure of the flame sets up a shell of force around it.
Well, that is the way to talk it.
No? Mr. Lanier.
Mr. Carr, from what you have been saying this morning, it seems likely that you and your co-pilot will be the first human being in history to enter outer space.
This is possible. We think that this is history-making, even this discussion here this morning, because we are so near to begin to do it.
In other words, we are sitting with a man who will be a hero of the ages if this comes off.
We don't expect to be a hero at any time. We want to be a good servant of our master, the Lord.
Let me take just a moment to ask you a couple of questions, Mr. Carr. What do you think of Van Tassel? Not personally, but his story.
We don't know very much about it. We had the good fortune this summer of visiting a giant rock for one night, wherein he was a wonderful host. We had very little opportunity to talk to him. We arrived late, and I was interested in going out in the desert for a little bit of possible observation of spacecraft. And the next morning, Mr. Van Tassel talked to me about his plans. They all sounded very sincere, and they most assuredly were uplifting. I, myself, have been so busy on the development of the OTC business and what we know that can come into reality, even though I do come across these people, I cannot explore what they are doing.
Let me ask you this, sir.
And I'd like a fair and square answer. And I feel that some of our listeners would like to hear your honest opinion about this. A good percentage of the listeners know Van Tassel, know him, because they've heard him. True, you haven't had a tremendous amount of time to observe and to check on some of the statements made by George Van Tassel. But I want to ask you this. Does it sound plausible to you, Mr. Carr, as a scientist, as an inventor, as a pioneer, that Mr. Van Tassel has the plans for a rejuvenating machine and the plans for the conoscope?
I can't answer this. I don't have such plans. I do not know of such plans. I have never seen this type where anything mechanically that man might do would do this. I say this, that we have within us the potential of total rejuvenation. Incidentally, man invented death. God did.
Well, I have a couple of other people I'd like to have opinions about. I would like your honest opinion about Howard Menger and George Adamski. But I want you to take a moment to think about this before you comment on either one of those two gentlemen. And I know that you spent a considerable amount of time with Howard Menger. So certainly, you're possibly in a better position to discuss Menger than you are Van Tassel. I'll tell you what, instead of having you answer that question now, I think we'll take a coffee break at this time. We'll be back in just 20 minutes. I hope you people will be with us. And again, we'll pick up our interview with Otis T. Carr. Mr. Carr is the president of OTC Enterprises of Baltimore, Maryland. Mr. Norman Colton of OTC Enterprises is with us. Valerie Lanier, Ben Iskowitz, Dave Field, and Sam Vanderbilt representing Argosy Magazine, taking pictures tonight, which should appear in the April or March edition with the Herb Bailey story. Just in case you've joined us during the past few minutes, let me remind you that Mr. Carr is the man who has made the statement, and the announcement has been officially made, that he will leave at 12:01 a.m. on the 7th day of December, the year of 1959, for the moon in the OTC X1 circular foil craft. We have been told that the craft will depart from Space, Maryland, in a vertical rise and beginning orbit of the Earth at a speed of 5,000 miles per hour. We'll find out more about this and more about the opinions of Mr. Carr as far as the other so-called contactees are concerned. We'll get all of this information when we come back in just 20 minutes. This is WOR Radio, your station in New York, and this is Long John with the party line, 710 on the dial. We get back with our guests again. I would like to remind our listeners that if you'd like to join us some morning, if you have something you'd like to talk about, you're more than welcome to send me your name, address, and phone number. Put interview in the outside of the envelope. And I'll turn that request over to our Continuity Acceptance Department. Also, please give me a little idea what you'd like to talk about. And maybe you'll be with us in another couple of weeks. I hope so. We've got a couple of rough ones here, Otis. A couple of rough ones. And, well, here's one here from Montreal, Quebec. Don't worry about the car contraption, because it will never take off for anywhere. He is all wet. W. A. Susie. Is that how you pronounce it? S. O. Susie. No need for a comment?
No comment.
Thank you.
We don't know about Mr. Soucy, but there's a very eminent Canadian citizen who has publicly confirmed that what Mr. Clark says he can and will do, that he can and will do. We're not at this moment permitted to mention his name, but we have that writing from him.
Would you put your hands down? You're covering the microphone.
Oh,
thank you very much, Mr. Cole. Well, here's another one. This is from a gentleman in Yonkers, New York. He has requested me not to use his name, which we certainly give any of our listeners the right, the same as you've mentioned the his eminent scientist in Canada. Who agrees with Mr. Carr's theories, and you're the one that's developed his name.
You can keep that.
And I'll have to keep this one, too. However, this man is not quite as enthused about Mr. Carr as the gentleman in Canada. Of course, this man lives in Yonkers, and people in Yonkers, they're not enthusiastic, as you know. Mr. Carr, like Van Tassel, don't you need
$2 or $3 million building, too?
Oui.
The space research hangar alone will cost more than that cost. Approximately $2 million. And the craft will cost about $1,500,000.
Can you just say, what were you trying to sell for $20 million?
We said complete tooling. This is six buildings.
Right. The plant. The plant. The
whole plant. Mm-hmm.
It's understandable.
Here's one more from Fanwood, New Jersey. I've never heard of Fanwood, New Jersey.
What about
the plant?
Get close to Plainfield, John. Fanwood? Near Plainfield, on Route 22.
It's in that neighborhood, right? Just north of
Fanwood, New Jersey. This is from Harold H. Monsen. M-O-N-S-E-N. Fanwood, New Jersey. Harold H. Monsen. Here's Mr. Monsen's question and statement. The most efficient electrical accumulator that we know today will deliver only 80 to 85% of the energy put into it. How can you spend 100 units of power and recover only 85 units for later delivery and keep going?
Now, I don't even understand this, but I know you do, Mr. Clark.
He may have been talking about the development of Mr. Kettering, the formaldehyde, burning formaldehyde to produce electromotive force. We have a different principle. We are applying atmospheric electricity, electrostatic charges in our capacitor plate, and are drawing electricity out of the atmosphere and successfully putting it to work, we feel, for the first time.
You sure, sir?
Yes.
Here's a telegram from Glenhead, New York. Mr. Carr said Russians exceeded speed of light. This is not true. They have accelerated an electron in water greater than speed of light in water. The speed of light in water is only 3/4 the speed of light in a vacuum, Mr. Mink.
We note that the Nobel Prize publication, as put in the paper, stated that there was a variance in the constant of the speed of light as we know it. The whole technical subject here is one that I wouldn't care to go into. We have felt for many years that we invented the speed of light, that light in reality is and does not necessarily have to be considered in velocities of any manner. Being man-made, most of the things that man invents, he improves upon. I think that this constant of the speed of light, which has the weakness of the observer, we cannot have a constant measurement unless we have an absolute zero. We cannot have an absolute zero unless there is no motion. and the observer always being in motion, his evaluations of the speed of light are open to consideration, conjecture, and possibly error.
Ben Isquith?
Mr. Carr, I wonder what you think about the news story that was reported recently in the New York, the front page of the New York Times. I think it was at Columbia University where two scientists used mazes, which are sort of atomic clocks, and got degrees of fantastic accuracy and verified the Michelson-Morley experiment in an entirely new technique. That's once again reaffirming Einstein's principle about the constancy of the speed of light.
Dr. Einstein always questioned the one weakness in it, and this is the observer. If the speed of light is constant and it is going in one direction at 186,000 miles an hour, and something else passes it going at the same speed, what velocity do we have?
This is exactly the point. The speed of light going against the Earth and the speed of light going with the Earth was measured. Now, theoretically, the beam of light that is traveling with the Earth should have a different velocity than the beam of light that is going against the Earth when you measure it. Now, upon experimentation, this is found to be exactly equal. It's the fact that there are only two possible conclusions to this kind of experiment. One, that the Earth is not moving, it's standing still. Or two, that the speed of light is constant.
Gentlemen,
whether or not whether or not you are traveling with it as a velocity, or whether you're traveling against it or away from it.
I'm a little confused at this moment. That I was under the impression it was 186,000 miles per second, not an hour.
Per second.
Did I say that?
Well, no, I may have said
I was wondering if there's been a change.
I've been so interested in in the hour flight of my craft. But this always has the weakness of the observer again. We ourselves, in this dimension, three dimensions, cannot possibly evaluate and say that this is total because there are other dimensions. Now, they have found out that thought is that they have not been able to measure the velocity of thought. It can be instantaneous from one individual to another around the Earth or halfway around it. This, therefore, sets up another constant, which is entirely different from the constant, as we call, speed of light. And so far as we know, anything that has a velocity, sometime or other, must have mass and must have weight. And we don't know of anyone who has ever told us what the weight of a dream was.
A photon has weight.
That's right, but we still don't know what the weight of an image is.
But the question in the suit is not the velocity of dreams, the velocity of light.
Therefore, we have possibilities of other measurements which we have not yet been conscious of. We are confident that it will be found that this manufactured time equation and speed, which is a man-made equation, will have many variations the very first time that man himself, a three-dimensional creature, moves into another force field outside of the one he's living in. This means that we shall experience some of this between even the Earth and the Moon, because at the time when we arrive at where the Moon has a greater gravity pull for our craft than the Earth has, we will have hit a point of zero time. And when we start to move in under the influence of the Moon, we will have joined what we have stated from the beginning. We've become a fourth-dimensional being. We've gone away from the dimension that rule us into another dimension. Even though it may be the same force field, maybe the same identical type of gravity, we have gone into another dimension. And in our releases, when we first made them public, we said we had invented a fourth-dimensional space vehicle. We still stand beside this. We think that when we have returned from our flight to the Moon, we'll be able to tell you something about time,
and about velocities that are different from what is now accepted.
But, Mr. Carr, you leave me sort of gasping for words because I don't know whether, I mean, I don't know whether it's due to my own complete lack of insight or whether or not you're playing with words with me, but when you talk and discuss the speed of light and then say it's, the speed of dreams has not been measured, therefore we don't know anything about light. I mean, is this a method of investigation or of thinking that you use in your own work? Can I just add one thing? I mean, it has always seemed to me that terms such as the immediacy of thought and the speed of a dream or a vision, these things to me seem to be nothing more or less than allegorical statements, whereas a statement about the speed of light is not an allegorical statement.
It is one made by our conscious observation on a three-dimensional plane. From another dimension, it could be entirely different. And believe me, some of the best thinkers on Earth are trying to consider this problem. Even Professor Picard has stated that it's possible for a man to be on a two-month journey into another galaxy and come back and find that 1,000 years had passed here on this Earth, and all the things that he might have liked and adored were already crumbled into dust. Now, thinking men have come up with these evaluations, and believe me, our consideration of time and our evaluation of the velocity of radiance may come up with some changes.
May I get into this again, Ben, or do you have some further line of questions?
I would like to, of course, I want to get back to a couple of my questions, Mr. Carr. I haven't completed my line of questioning in reference to George Van Tassel, Dan Fry, Howard Menger, George Adamski, and I could go on and on. But I wonder if we could move a couple of these containers away. Dave Fields, would you be kind enough to come in here a moment? I want to get a couple of these things away so I can read this. I have in front of me at the present time, pardon me, an ad that is a layout of a full-page ad, the size of the newspaper would be the full-size newspaper such as the New York Times or the Herald Tribune, not a tabloid size like the News or the Mirror. And this would be a full-page ad. It reads, "Help wanted. Men of courage and vision needed for space age. OTC Enterprises proudly assumes its leadership for the third electrical age." And
this is a little difficult for me to read. It's not large enough, but being an elderly person, I have bifocals. I'm trying to read it. It's tough.
Let's get this again. Help wanted. Men of courage and vision needed for a space age. Highly trained engineers for electronics, astronautics, electricity, hydraulics, architects, structural designers, celestial mechanics, electrogravitics, space form design. Also technical writers, administrators, executives, sales engineers, personnel experts. Also, foreign representatives, foreign manufacturers, and I could go on and on, but do you want to set that down? Let me read some of the copy for a moment that I have in front of me that will be a part of this ad. There has never been in the history of the United States, and there never will be again within the next 100 years, anywhere in the world, another opportunity for the application of talent and capital resulting in great wealth, prestige, and lasting security as the one presented here. These are the facts and will be demonstrated to qualified men and women of sound judgment who have the inherent tendency and ability to go ahead when the majority doubts and waits. Read this.
and read it carefully. Space experts in all countries are spending millions of dollars, francs, pounds, marks, and rubles in a wild race for supremacy of space and space exploitation. More than 2 years ago, our president, Mr. Otis T. Carr, publicly offered the world his electrified propulsion system for practical space flight. Now, 2 years later, after tons of newspaper headlines and a $19 billion worth of disappointment and failure, comes respected scientist Dr. Hermann Oberth to acknowledge that the rockets are all wrong. So Carr was, and still is, right. Now, I have not read all of the copy. There's much, much more to this ad. I have been told that this ad will appear in the very near future in the Wall Street Journal and other financial papers in different parts of this country. And now I would like to ask you, Mr. Carr or Mr. Colton, a few questions about this ad. The first question, do you mean because Dr. Hermann Oberth, have I pronounced that correctly, incidentally? Is that right, Ellen?
Yes, Oberth? Correct, yes.
Do you mean to say, gentlemen, that because Dr. Hermann Oberth claims that rockets are all wrong, that this implies that Otis T. Carr is right?
Dr. Oberth, in this statement, said that electricity would probably be the power. And this is the power that we have claimed from the beginning, and which we know to be correct. The great Nikola Tesla, who brought this into our consciousness when we knew him for 3 years, from 1925 to 1928, Mr. Tesla told us, he said, it would be impossible for a man to travel in space unless he has a universal source of power with him that he can carry with him, that he can bring back with him. And this led us into the exploration, which is now a success.
Mr. Carr, when you had the pleasure of knowing the gentleman whose name you pronounced as Tesla, did he ever correct you and tell you that the correct pronunciation is Tesla?
Never once, and I don't ever recall even mentioning his name more than once or twice. When I first met him, I was a youth of 20 years old. I was told that his name was Tesla. I know that it's Tesla. But over the years, I thought of him in this name, and I never changed it in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Now, before I continue my line of questioning, I'd like to read some other parts of this ad, the copy. Otis T. Carr, a Baltimore, Maryland inventor, scientist, and explorer of nature's secrets, has succeeded during his 35 years of research, experimentation, trials, and tribulations to harness some of nature's power and energy. Setting aside most conventional conceptions of power and locomotion, he now uses the interplay of gravity and electromagnetism in a delicate balance of enormous potential power. Do you really do this, Mr. Carr?
Absolutely. This we do. This is not an idle statement. There are thousands and thousands, countless, innumerable applications of these principles for every type of captive power or mobile power that you could think of. We will have the electric torch that will produce very small, that will produce 12 volts for months, as compared to any other system that we know of now. We will be able to electrify wheel transportation on the ground, such as automobiles, so forth. And in captive applications, we will be able to make generating plants for electromotive force available anywhere on this earth without fuel, expendable fuel.
Mr. Carr, if I may continue reading parts of this ad. Virtually free universal power, which can be used to run anything from an electric razor to a steel mill, to a spaceship, and at a fraction of the cost of today's power system. These startling scientific proven accomplishments open up new rich frontiers for all those qualified, talented men and women who are prepared to participate in this new age of space activities. High positions, fortunes and fame, lifetime top careers await those who are ready to join this new and thrilling venture into the space age. High-type talent in all fields, hard work, and great sacrifices are called for to qualify for participation in this new age organization.
When this ad appears in the Wall Street Journal and other financial papers, do you honestly think that there will be a need on the part of the OTC enterprises for all of these people that you seem to feel that you need?
We will employ at Space Maryland approximately 800 people. We want the very best to introduce these principles. We will only build prototypes here. We need a lot of engineers to work on various applications. We need vision, we need talent, and it will be a sort of a very enlarged Menlo Park, wherein men with their hands and with their brains and with new inspiration will come up with ideas that we don't even dream of here now.
Mr. Carr, one question is in my mind, and it has been since we started the coffee break. I was looking at this ad. I enjoy the copy. I think it's a great job as far as copy is concerned. My compliments to the writer.
Mr. Colton had a hand in it.
Excellent, Mr. Colton. But the question is this, sir. If you really need all of these people, and I went through that a couple of minutes ago, engineers, scientists, and I don't know how many different professions, wouldn't it be advisable to put this ad in the New York Times, the Herald Tribune, possibly even in the New York Journal American or the New York Daily News or the Mirror or some papers like that, instead of financial papers? Do you honestly think that all of these professional people buy the Wall Street Journal?
We're confident that the distribution that is national of any type of publication that deals to all the people all over the country will reach sufficient number of interested people to fill our needs. In choosing a publication like the Wall Street Journal, is unquestionably there will be comments about this advertisement, and it will have a lasting weight to it that we feel will quickly fill all of our needs. Now,
financially or as far as employees are concerned?
We mentioned all of our needs, and all of our needs is about everything that you can think of.
To break that down a little further, John.
Yes, Mr.
You know that the periodicals are divided categorically as general and special. The special audiences of the top circulation financial dailies are the people this ad is most likely to appeal to.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, these are the people who are in daily touch with the commodity and economic environment. They are the people who, when we say in our headline, the third electrical age, will immediately have a proper concept of the bigness of this enterprise. It is as though alternating current itself were being reintroduced. And to get a picture in your imagination of the scope of the new basis for all industry and commerce, just think of it in terms of the alternating current system being reintroduced in another form, which does not use conventional fuels for prime motivation. We use the free, abundant space forces as the prime mover for these energy systems and these propulsion power packages.
Mr. Colton, I was asking Mr. Carr about George Van Tassel. Instead of going back to Mr. Carr, I'd like to swing this line of questioning in your direction, sir. As a businessman, I don't think that you've ever labeled yourself as a scientist or an inventor. Imagine you're the businessman. Is that right, sir?
I like to label myself the communicator.
Fine. All right. Will you communicate with me for a little while? Do you think that there is any remote possibility that Mr. Carr is so reluctant to give us an opinion about Mr. Van Tassel that this can indirectly be detrimental to the potential of OTC enterprises? In other words, a large percentage of the people that listened to George Van Tassel on this over this station, not once, but possibly five or six times, they've heard George describe the Conoscope. I think it's aptly named. They have also heard George describe the crushed head of a lizard. And this lizard was picked up, dead naturally, placed into the rejuvenating machine out in the desert. And in a matter of seconds, the lizard came right out of that machine, the head completely restored. Brain surgeons were there back in October 1956 when I first heard the story. Recently, there were not brain surgeons. We're not quite sure whether it was a lizard, but a couple of guys were out in the desert with this camp. Now, what do you think, Mr. Colton, and I'm asking you, I'm being very sincere, as the communicator, I want you to communicate with me and tell me, if you were at home at the present time listening, and you heard this whole story from George Van Tassel, and you heard the story from Dan Fry describing a piece of metal, extraterrestrial metal, hovering over the table. A man went to grab the piece of metal. He put it in his pocket, sat over in the sidelines of this studio. And in a matter of 30 or 40 seconds, the metal just flew right out of his pocket, hovered once again over this table, and then landed on the table, which actually it didn't happen that way. But when these stories are repeated over the air, do you think that this can be a good public relation value to the OTC enterprises to have the president sit in front of the microphone tonight and say, yes, it could be possible. Yes, I know that we have many, many lives. What do you think about this, Mr. Communicator?
I fully agree with it.
With George Van Tassel?
I fully agree with Mr. Carr's statement, which was not, as I recall it, in direct respect to George Van Tassel. But I myself have become convinced that whatever man can imagine or whatever man can image, man can do or man can cause to be done. I don't think that in my acquaintance with Mr. Carr he's ever dealt in personalities, Van Tassel or otherwise, or that he has ever conjectured about any of his scientific statements.
Statements? Van Tassel?
About anyone's.
Oh, I see.
He deals strictly in fact, not in fantasy or fiction.
And in our nearly 2 years of association, in which I am constantly being exposed to sources of basic information and the known constants of nature, I've never found Mr. Clark to have contradicted himself. And so on this subject of rejuvenation, all I know is that I'm told by the pathologist that man rejuvenates himself ever so often in the course of his lifetime.
Well, then we wouldn't need a machine if man can do it himself.
Well, man can do a lot of things himself that no machine has ever done. No scientist has ever made a man, but a man can make a man. And does quite frequently.
Well, Mr. Communicator, Norman Colton again. I have another question. Not one, but maybe two or three, or at least one question with a couple of parts. We've talked tonight and on other nights with you gentlemen about $20 million, which in my book is a lot of money. I mean, it may not be a lot of money to build spaceships. It's a lot of money if you're going out to buy jelly beans with it. But the thought comes to my mind, here is a man out in California, at Giant Rock Airport, and all this man needs is a mere pittance, $30,000. In my book, this is nothing. Not that I've ever had that type of money. I've never been even near anybody that has that type of money, but $30,000 is a nothing compared to $20 million. Now, true, I can see that this would be, it would be great for kicks to go to the moon, and scientific, as far as science is concerned, it may be of great value to be able to go to the moon, and I certainly want to be first in line to, pardon me, congratulate Mr. Carr for attempting this trip when he does. But I would like to ask you this. Wouldn't it be better for us to at least delay this trip, let's say, for a couple of weeks and take $30,000 and give it to George Van Tassel so we can get this rejuvenating machine working, which will be of great value to the people on this planet? And let's face it, Mr. Communicator, let's think of our own people before we think of the moon people, before we think of the Martians and the Venusians. And we don't even know if they're going to be nice to us. We don't even know if they're there. How about taking care of those that are dear and near to us, our own friends, our own family? Wouldn't it be worthwhile getting $30,000 together? That, in my book, is like 30 cents when you talk in terms of $20 million.
Well, as Shakespeare Bacon put it, to each his own. We're dealing with miniaturizations of space forms and space forces to get practical applications of energies for mechanical motion and for transportation. Our flight to the moon will demonstrate that man is able to leave the Earth's gravity field and successfully enter space. As the satellites have already shown, once a device gets into outer space, it is able, at a distance of about 500-600 miles, to circumnavigate the Earth in about an hour and a half. And so for immediate needs of transportation and communication, when we demonstrate practical space flight in orbit outside the Earth's atmosphere, we will have demonstrated that it is possible to have manned flight around the world in a passenger-carrying aircraft in an hour and a half. And so here we have a craft which, if you look at it as I did when Mr. Carr first exposed it to me, in itself appears to be a miniature solar system with its sun at the center and the planets and the moons in a certain relationship surrounding it. And so it behaves like a miniature solar system and generates and miniaturizes the natural available space.
space forces which move the planets and moons in the solar system.
As the communicator of this organization, do you lack confidence in Mr. Van Tassel's rejuvenating machine that you would rather not suggest to the stockholders of OTC Enterprises Incorporated to take a measly $30,000 to help their fellow man to rejuvenate?
I wouldn't label the $30,000 as measly.
Gee, it is if you got $20,000. I've got in my pocket now about $30, and I mean, if I lost 30 cents, I mean, the world wouldn't come to an end.
Well, I would say this, that if Mr. Van Tassel has been able to adequately demonstrate the basic validity of his principles, then someone somewhere who is as interested in rejuvenation as we are in the reproduction of natural forces for motion and energy and propulsion and so forth, that there are lots of people who would be willing to give Mr. Van Tassel the money he needs to develop his principles.
Now, I want to ask you about... you see, I didn't want to put you on a spot as far as what you thought of Van Tassel, because actually you don't know him that well.
No, I've never met him.
Okay, I'm aware of that. Now I'm going to ask you about a man by the name of Menger, Howard Menger. What is your opinion, sir?
Well, there is another peculiar circumstance. I've sat up many a night listening to your very interesting dialogue with Mr. Menger. So when we had the opportunity to visit his farm in New Jersey not too long ago, I was hoping to have some conversation with Mr. Menger. But we were both so busy in so many different directions with the small groups from among the many hundreds there asking each of us different kinds of questions at different places around the lawn and in the rooms of the house. All I got to say to Mr. Menger was hello and goodbye.
Do you have any confidence in his story at all? You're familiar with the story, I know that.
I've heard his story many times. All I can say is that he tells it the same way every time. He seems sincere. He seems to believe what he says. He represents his experiences as having been real, and I'm just not in a position to question or doubt or criticize in any way.
Now, my next question, Mr. Colton, and again, I address this question to you as the communicator of OTC Enterprises rather than discussing it with Mr. Carr. I know Mr. Carr is very busy working on and planning for this trip to the moon, whereas you're sort of down on the ground with both feet on the ground, and you're thinking in terms of the problems that we have on this planet, and let Mr. Carr be concerned about what's happening on the moon. I want to ask you this, sir. If Mr. Menger's story is true, if Mr. Van Tassel's story is true, if Mr. Adamski's story is true, and Mr. Dan Fry's story, wouldn't it be very, very practical? I'll throw in the Mystic Barber, too, for you, to give you what we'll call the Big Five. Wouldn't it be practical for you, sir, Norman Colton, the businessman, the communicator for OTC Enterprises, to spend a few dollars, what could it cost, maybe $500 for each of these men, a measly $2,500, to gather these five, the Big Five, together at the offices of OTC Enterprise in Baltimore, Maryland, and sit these men down and talk to them and say, now, gentlemen, look, our president has confidence in you. He stated this on the Long John show not long ago. And I have no reason to doubt your story or even to discount it. You sound like sincere gentlemen. And we all are interested in one thing, to help our fellow man. We're trying to bring the message. We have the craft ready. You men have had contact with the Venusians, the Martians. One of you Mr. Sinatra, you've been to the moon. Mr. Adamski, you've seen these saucers. You've had contact with these people. Mr. Fry, you've been in one. Mr. Menger, you've been to Venus and Mars. And Mr. Van Tassel, you communicate telepathically. Let's all get together. Instead of having the big five, let's have the large six and see what we can do. Wouldn't this be a practical approach, Mr. Colton?
You know, sometimes it's not only all I can do to give you a straight answer, it's all I can do to keep a straight face.
Are you laughing at me, sir? No, if you are, fine. Do you think that my question is a stupid question?
Well,
is it a ridiculous question? I'll answer
it this way, and it's pure hypothesis, of course. I used to do a little selling some years ago, and I knew I had the best product, and I knew I had a fair price. And whenever it came to a showdown, I would always try to get the prospect to insist that my competitors all gather with me in one room and lay their stories on the line in competition with mine and let the prospect be the judge. I was never able to get my competitors to assent to this device. So I doubt in the hypothetical situation you set up that if I had the $2,500 and was willing to spend it to produce this situation, that I would even be able to get all five to discuss joining with the sixth, because as I have heard their different stories and the interrogations that have taken place on your show...
Questioning.
These men... I beg your pardon?
Questioning, sir. I prefer that word.
Questioning ceremonies?
Questioning instead of interrogations.
Questionings.
I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Questionings and answerings.
Continue, please.
These men seem to have diverse interests and have had diverse experiences with dogs and potatoes and one thing and another. You have seen all these things, and I never have.
The dog and the potatoes? No, sir. I'm sorry. You're not listening to this. I saw a rock here that somebody claimed was a potato. And as far as the dog, I never saw the dog. I didn't even see the car, about 385-pound Venusian dog.
Well, I'm glad after many hours of listening and waiting to know exactly what this...
The story is not a part of the big five. I think you know what I'm trying to do right now, Norman. I'm trying to get from you, as the director of sales engineering of OTC Enterprises, I'm trying to have you go on record and say that you have what you consider to be a business. In other words, you feel that you have something that is legitimate, something that can be accomplished. I mean, not just a dream. And if you tell yourself, but as a director of a corporation, if you tie up with Van Tassel and the Dan Fry and the Menger and the Adamski stories, it is only natural for people listening to presume that you have a lot of wild tales, too. Maybe you have. I don't know.
Well, to cut across a lot of corners, if your assumption is that we discolor ourselves by association, as you said before, you had a legitimate mission in attending the Menger Convention.
Mm-hmm. As a reporter.
Other qualified reporters have functioned in similar missions at other sessions we've attended and at which Mr. Carr's appeared on the lecture platform. And regardless of the composition of the live audience, which may have been anywhere from 60 to several thousand people at any given time and place, the newspapers, radio stations, television reporters, and so on around the country have faithfully reported Mr. Carr's statements. He has not made statements he is not willing to back up. He has been able successfully to back up every statement he's ever made.
And so regardless of the experiences and opinions, the anecdotes and conjectures, the one thing and another among the various people in these audience groups, Mr. Carr's appearances before them and among them have resulted in very wide publicity and very serious identification for the principles he has set forth. This has been our purpose, our mission, and up to this time, very largely accomplished, as it's being tonight, where we have this opportunity to speak to what I imagine are millions of people in the 27 states your broadcast signal reaches.
This is WOR Radio, your station in New York. My name is Long John. We call this the Party Line. Another question, Norman. Why is it that other big corporations, Westinghouse, General Motors, Aerojet Corporation, and I could go on and on and on, when they manufacture any part of a rocket, and very frankly, I don't know enough about rocketry to know what percentage of a rocket any given company may manufacture their plant. But why is it that when they run ads, pardon me, institutional ads in the slick magazines, and they talk about rocketry in these ads, and they don't say anything about those wonderful people living on the moon, those great Venusians or those nice Martians. They try to tell us in the ads what they're doing to advance rocketry. They try to tell us in these institutional ads that it will be of value for us to get to the moon and why. And even the artists have tried to capture in their drawings, in their paintings, what the moon may possibly look like. And believe me, all of the artist conceptions that I have seen include nothing as far as people, nice or even nasty people. Why is it that OTC Enterprises, and I think that the president of the company never stated on any program, including tonight's, that he is receiving telepathic communications from other planets. I don't think he claims to be a metaphysician or a mystical in that manner. Why is it that the president of this corporation, OTC Enterprises, though, constantly goes back to saying, we are out to help our fellow man so we can get to the moon and meet the nice people on the moon? Why is it?
May I answer?
Surely, Mr. Carr, you certainly welcome.
I didn't say to meet the nice people. If they're nice people there, I want to meet them. We don't know what.
You haven't implied, sir, time and time again, that these people are nice people?
These people
are different because they've never attempted to attack our planet?
We have not stated in any of our literature or our published releases or on the air or publicly that we know that these people exist. We do know there are spacecraft. We have seen them. We do not know what the personalities are that run them. We have theories which we cannot prove. There could be people on the moon. We don't know.
You make the statement this morning, you do not know.
That's right.
Are there people on Venus?
There could be.
You don't know this?
Or I have not seen them.
Well, we know that you haven't seen them because you haven't been there. But are you saying, sir, then that at the present time, you don't have full confidence in Mr. Van Tassel, Dan Fry, Howard Menger, Adamski, Buck Nelson, etc.?
As Mr. Colton has said, to each his own, the one person whom I know is Mr. Dan Fry. I know that he is making some of the best guidance systems there are and that he is under contract to supply such systems to
the rocket industry, which in turn is for the United States government, that he has been trusted in this type of work of the highest clearance. He's technically qualified, and I have seen his plant. It is turning out excellent experimental equipment. Rating was anywhere, I believe. I have no reason to disbelieve Mr. Fry.
Are you talking about Fry, the inventor, Fry, the scientist, or Fry, the man that's been in a flying saucer?
If he says he's been in one, I am willing to believe him.
John, as the communicator, my objective is to achieve communication, which is a common understanding of a sane thing. Now, I don't propose to defend Mr. Carr, because I don't think he needs any defending. I don't propose to attack or fight us, because I don't think you have set this up to create controversy. We know what we're doing. We don't know what these other people are doing. In regard to these questions of life on other planets, while I haven't read the article thoroughly, the current issue of Time magazine, the science section, devotes about 2.5 pages to some hypotheses which attempt to prove that by all the standards of evaluation and deduction, there must be life of one kind and another, as the article puts it, on millions of other planets in this universe. So, in many of the statements he has made over the years, some of which at the time may have seemed far-fetched, fantastic, futuristic, day by day we find that Mr. Carr's statements are being borne out, supported, and proved by new knowledge and new facts learned about the natural conditions of the universe.
Mr. Cohen, I said I rest my case, but again, I'm going to have to reopen it. I haven't even said anything about Mr. Carr tonight. I am merely asking you, Mr. Colton, about Adamski, about Howard Menger, Dan Fry, George Van Tassel, Buck Nelson, and we'll stick with the scientist, with the inventor, Dan Fry. Do you honestly think this man has been in a flying saucer, sir? Not asking what Mr. Carr thinks now. I'm asking you, Mr. Communicator.
I can't think he has, and I can't think he hasn't. I just don't know. I know that he says he has been, and I agree with Mr. Carr that from my knowledge of Mr. Fry's technical background, his abilities, his skills, his status, his profession, and his commercial activities in which he is producing some of the finest magnetic measuring devices, control systems, guidance systems, and other
without doing the commercial for Dan Fry, does this make it so when the man tells you he's been in a flying saucer? What do you think of me? You think I'm a fairly honest guy?
I think you're a terrific reporter and communicator yourself.
No, I'm. Do you think I'm a fairly honest guy? Look, I work for one of the largest stations in the country, WOR. Certainly the FBI are not waiting outside to grab me or anything. So I must be a fairly honest guy if we're going to compare, if we're going to put Dan, the same standards that you measure Dan Fry's honesty. Let me ask you this question. Do you realize that right at the present time, Mr. Colton, that I am here only in the physical body, that my astral body is in Newark, New Jersey? Would you believe that, sir, if I told you that with a straight face?
I would believe in the possibility of it, yes.
There's a little doubt in your mind, though?
There's a little doubt in all our minds.
Uh-huh. Would you say then, sir, that if I constantly reported this experience of astrally projecting myself, and you've had the opportunity of being around with me a few times, and I offered you no conclusive proof of this. In other words, if you say, well, John, this is fine, I believe you. Where are you projected at the present time? And I say, I'm in front of 191 Market Street in Newark, New Jersey, and
you get on the phone and you find the phone number of the candy store or whatever's adjacent to, or rather, whatever is located at 191 Market Street, and you say, is there a fella standing there? And there's no sign of me, and I tell you, look, I'm lifting up a Hershey bar at the present time. The woman who owns the candy store, it will appear to her that the Hershey bar is being levitated. And she says, nothing has happened there. Now, if I kept telling you this, and you'd go back to Ball, and you'd say, you know, I think this guy, Long John, I think he's really nuts, or he's a liar. Would you want to do business with me, sir?
Well, I would say that if you continually made statements of this kind, and if the management of WOR kept you continually on its air, and the sponsors that make your program possible continued to pay your bills, then I would consider that there was rather good possibility that what you were saying was more true than false.
Boss, if you're listening, I'm not astrally projected. I'm here with the astral and the physical body. I'm giving you 100% tonight.
I answered to that sometimes.
Have you listened to...
I was listening to part of it on the car coming in, John.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say that I'm au courant on everything that's happened because there are bridges and tunnels and other things, but I got most of it, I think.
You mean to tell me that when I am on the air, that you would even go through a tunnel to lose one single word of this interesting show?
John, normally I wouldn't, but my levitator wasn't working.
Go over it, right. Lester, possibly you'd like to ask our guests a couple of questions, either Mr. Carr or Mr. Colton.
Well, I don't know to whom this should be addressed, but I heard one of the gentlemen, I think it was Mr. Carr, saying something about $1.5 million for the actual cost of the ship. And I believe that the rest of this $20 million originally needed was for the tooling up, the buildings, and other things. Am I correct on that?
That is right.
This, frankly, strikes me as a little strange. I was working in an aircraft plant. The housing in which we were, the entire building, cost a little less than $35,000. The tools cost about $120,000. They were a good deal more valuable than what they were in. One of the planes, and this is an experimental one, on which I was working, was going to cost a good deal more than $2 million. In other words, you might say that under $200,000 was needed to build a $2 million plane, the first one. And this was a highly experimental one. There was a great deal more work required on it than there was on an ordinary plane. It was all built there, unlike most of the planes that we built. In other words, there were no subcontracts at the time of any importance, except the normal ones for bolts, screws, and all, and other made parts. It seems to me that if you are so eager to get this circular foil spacecraft up, that rather than wasting time, as it would seem to me, on a fancy plant and on special tools and so on, that you would go ahead and put it up in anything you could find, and use practically every dollar that you could rake up in building this to test it. Now, can you explain why this does not seem to be so?
We're moving in this direction very fast. If you will notice, the fabricated model here, it is made by a qualified engineer, tool designer, and a college graduate. He is a high-priced, high-qualified man. Yeah, I am confident that patterns were made even in your plant. If you didn't make them where you were speaking about, you bought them. We are moving with as much rapidity as possible to build the operational prototype, flying model, which will be an exact replica of the craft that we will take on our journey to the moon. We mentioned our program, which sounded ambitious to a lot of people, but compared to what has been spent in missiles is only a drop in the bucket, as something to introduce a new age, the third electrical age. This includes 6 buildings, the Space Research Institute at Space, Maryland. This is a prototype. All of the buildings are cells for the world to see.
Well, this is all very lovely, but don't you think that with the Russians at the present time well ahead of us in space,
There was an absolutely crying need for advances on our part, for prestige, if not for accomplishment, to gain back some of the reputation we have lost to the world, which is hurting our commerce, our industry, and our government operations. Don't you think that it would be better to shelve all the trimmings, all of the nice things, all of the desirable things, all of the monuments in advance? And so far as I know, you have not lifted a man from space yet. I think it would be better to wait to build the monument until after you have lifted him.
We have a very conservative program. We move in the direction of its completion, and we are, so far as I know, the only human beings on Earth. And believe me, there are billions behind the others who have come out and stated what day they were going on a journey out into space. Now, this is accelerated program. The men who can get $20 billion a year appropriated are talking 5 years from now. We're talking 1 year and 2 weeks from now.
I still don't see what this has to do with the need for all the buildings.
We don't particularly say it has a need for all the buildings. We say that the culmination of our effort will be these buildings, so that the whole world will be able to know that a new age is here, because we can prove it. And we will have there the prototype in which to do it.